Welcome back to Nota Bene. We're still on the lagoon, Nate Freeman.
There we are. La Serenissima is cloudy today, but still rocking.
Days have lost meaning. It takes me twice as long to get anywhere or do anything that I planned in my itinerary, and I'm so happy about it all.
Yeah.
All I've had to eat, I'm not really fasting while I'm here, other than I eat gelato right during the day, mm-hmm. and then we have these 9 o'clock dinners that actually you begin eating at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I'm so fucking happy.
Yeah, I have not been on the late dinner tip in a long time. I'm really enjoying it.
We're in Europe. Europeans here.
Mm-hmm. It's marvelous.
I'm a little tired. I'm sucking down the Diet Coke. We're trying to get geared up. There is so much to talk about. I have seen so many people, really all of the people, so much art.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a blur, but I'm beginning to formulate my thoughts and opinions. I think what we should do, man, is mm-hmm. we should just go through like chronologically.
Okay.
In terms of the evening events, and then we'll circle back and we'll talk about the Biennale and our top art picks here in Venice.
Let's do it.
Does that work for you?
Totally.
We both just ran into this hotel room, which I'm kind of liking this hotel. I mean, it's dowdy. It's like very like, you know, fake Venetian, but I like it.
It's a great location, for sure.
They press my pants for me every day, which is really nice. Important. I don't want to be wrinkly and do my laundry. So let's both pull up our phones, because I know for me, my brain is such mush right now. I kind of need to look at the pictures of all the things we've seen and done to remember what was on what day.
We last chatted on Monday when you just got into town. That seems like so long ago, my lord.
That feels like a lifetime ago. I think I've aged a lot since then.
Yes.
Yeah, really, really have. And let's get into it. On Monday, what did we do?
Well, after that wonderful interview with Alison Gingeris, which if you haven't listened, obviously take a listen. It's a banger. I went to see a show by a little artist named Willem de Kooning.
Oh, casual.
Yeah.
Casual. Was it a big opening and dinner sort of sitch?
That it was. That it was, Benjamin.
Who was in attendance? Because I will talk about the art in a minute, but like I looked at some of the lender labels, and it was everyone.
So there was a wonderful, very chill reception at the Academia. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Show's great. Like you said, some major loans from top flight institutions around the world. The show focuses on two trips that de Kooning took to Italy that truly inspired him. When he was back in the studio in New York, he would say that he was thinking of Italy, that the Renaissance paintings that he saw influenced his palette. He always thought of himself kind of not as an abstract painter, but as a Renaissance painter, and he was painting like the gods did, like the greats did, and that all stems from his trips to Italy.
Yeah, and you saw him, because of his trips to Italy, begin to work with sculpture for the first time. Never considered himself a sculptor, but they had a lot of the sculpture that he turned to later. It was incredible exhibition. They joined together a lot of pictures that hadn't ever been in the same room since they were shown in gallery shows or in exhibitions at the around the time of their creation, which was incredible.
Yeah.
It was super well installed. And also, because he was such an East Ender from the East End of Long Island and did a lot of his painting out there, and the reflection of light on water and that horizontal maritime light very much affected his painting palette, one would argue. You also saw that, to see that in the city of Venice, where the light by the water has always been such an important factor for painters going back half a millennia. I think the commonality and the intersection there was really interesting. It's the best pure painting exhibition in Venice right now. Full stop, no competition.
Very well said. No notes. But I can add a bit of color commentary from the dinner if you'd like.
Yeah, because I saw the art, but I definitely was not invited to that dinner. That was a powerful one.
The dinner was at the Teatro Al Felice, which is the opera house here in Venice. You know, it actually burned down in 1836, and they rebuilt it. And then it burned down again in 1996. Arson.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh. You know, it's funny, for a city that is surrounded by water, there's a lot of fires in its history.
They actually banned fireplaces in Venice because of this
fire. I didn't know that,
The original one, the 1836 one. And so it's a relatively new building because they had to rebuild it, but it looks old, and it's very cool. It was catered by Harry's, which we'll get to later.
And who was in attendance? What kind of powerful people were there?
I mean, there were a lot of great people. The Archbishop Kossuth was there. There were a number of local eminents, but really what was fascinating was it was a dinner for the lenders, It wasn't like an opening day. It was specifically for the lenders. So there were a number of prominent museum directors in attendance. I spotted Max Hoyne from the Met, Mary Cerruti from the Walker, Jeremy from the Natural Sculpture Center, Melissa Chu from the Hirshhorn, Tom Campbell from the Fine Art Museum San Francisco, Klaus Biesenbach from the Neue National Gallery in Berlin, Scott Rothkopf from the Whitney, James Snyder from the Jewish Museum, the new director of the Guggenheim. It was crazy.
Wow, that is, it's like a symposium on like the top museum directors from around the world, kind of.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
That is a dope dinner.
Yeah, it was.
Were there any? You know, a lot of the pictures were simply, other than the museum pictures, were just listed as private collection. Did you notice anyone there that might have been those private collectors?
I don't want to speculate. One, and two, I don't think I could have connected the dots to anyone. There was no, you know, Ken Griffin there or anything.
Okay, yeah, I was looking for something like that. I mean, I'm sure that the emissaries from the Levy Gorvy Gallery were there, or Levy Gorvy Diane, excuse me.
Brett was there, yes.
Because I know that some of it were private collection courtesy, Levy Gorvy Diane.
Per Skarstedt was in attendance.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
A number of representatives from the Gagosian Gallery who have done a number of de Kooning shows. Other private dealers. Yeah, there were lots. There were some. It was, yeah, pretty heavy.
I think I ran right from where we were over to see Abby Bangzer's presentation of Objects and Thing.
Mm-hmm.
This really great designer whose name is definitely not in front of me right now, who's an American but is based out of Rome now, does these incredible, he takes paper and like uses weight to mash it way down and then cuts it crossways and sands it so it almost looks like terrazzo or marble or stone.
That's very cool.
Very, very, very cool stuff. Really interesting. And it was great to link up with her. And then I ran across the water to San Giorgio. I hailed a taxi with my arm. It was a water taxi, but it still felt pretty cool. Had a little on-the-spot negotiation. I didn't like the first price. We came to an agreement.
Great.
And he zipped me over to San Giorgio, where I was able to check out the Belinda de Burkhart, and I think I'm saying that right, exhibition that House on Verth has organized, I believe, over at the church there, the main church. Incredible work.
Right.
Like, so it looks like pieces of Renaissance paintings or even Dutch school paintings come to life, like little bits from the background, like flayed arms or bits of cloth, like, you know, like from a religious picture. Really incredible, but massive scaled in this huge museum space. And then I walked out to the cocktails, no Coke Light available or Coke Zero.
I'm sorry.
Didn't know a single person. It was the most European jam
I've ever
seen.
Love that.
It was kind of great. There was all these priests rolling around because it was in a church and they must be the priests of the church. Incredible. Incredible scene. It was in this garden.
None of them joined the party?
No, they did.
Oh, they did. Good.
Oh, no, they were at the cocktail party, and they knew more people than I did.
Sick.
I saw one was like showing people something on his cell phone, like, I don't know if his Grindr profiles or what, but it was crazy.
Wow. Priest with cell phones, boozing it up. We love to see it.
And I was worried that was it. There was like no real water on surf, but that was just like a cocktail half hour, 45 minutes. Then we wandered to the backside of San Giorgio and went to, there's a yacht club there, like a sailing club. It was incredible. It's not an old building. It's a fairly new building, but really nice. And the House on Worth people and more people I recognize started to roll in. Had a nice standing dinner there. It was pretty, pretty fun. And looking out, you kind of, as the sun was setting, because that was the sunny day that we had, the pure blue sky day. And it was incredible. But then I decided to switch it up a little bit, and some friends had a restaurant resi all the way across town. Did I get on the wrong Vaporetto? Yeah, I did. Did I end up even further away from my destination? Yes, I did. Was I still the first person to show up for a restaurant reservation? Yes, I was.
Venice, baby!
Absolutely, absolutely incredible stuff. So I hung out with, saw Brendan again and Meredith, and this interesting kind of photographer in a different world than ours, Gray Mallon. Which was really very interesting, and went to a fantastic restaurant whose name is right now escaping me, where it was like not a classic restaurant, although it used the classic Venetian flavors and ingredient profiles, but a little bit more contemporary. And it was called whatever the Italian word for pumpkin is.
This Zucca, restaurant is Zucca. Of course, Zucca.
And like, it was not a hidden spot, evidently, because even though super contemporary, incredible interior, beyond chic. I posted like a picture of the interior and like 20 people in my DMs like, Azuka, place is the greatest.
Great.
But next time you're there without a dinner obligation, I would highly recommend it.
Wonderful. I haven't gotten to any Venice hotspots. I haven't looked up Eater's top 30 restaurant in Venice. I don't know if that's the thing.
Zuka definitely would have been on it.
Yeah. I don't know if they have Resi here. I've been just going with the flow. I've been going to, you know, gallery dinners and the like every night. Speaking of which, I managed to stop by a little standing dinner for Sarah Z, celebrating her show at the Victoria Moreau Gallery here in town. Quite nice.
Was that same night on Monday
night?
I went and saw that show the other day. Incredible exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
Like on one level, you have this, I don't know how she did it, this video installation with all the hanging bits of paper.
No idea.
It's so sick, so good. And then upstairs, you have these incredible paintings that she painted on site here in Venice in mm-hmm. the upstairs of Victoria Moreau's, a space that she rents or controls. Great scale work. And the cool thing was you had this beautiful marble terrazzo floor, but that had all the paint drippings from Sarah's paintings, which I thought was really, really cool.
Really cool.
Yeah. That was a great show. And then I had, that was it. I had dinner, like dinner got over at 11:30. We closed the restaurant down. My colleagues went deep into the grappa list. It was a hectic and fun walk back. Rafael de Cardenas was with us, who's always super amusing and great to chat with. So he, Brendan and I walked through the darkened streets of Venice.
Magical.
It was magical. Because I really wanted to get into it on Tuesday, and into it I did. Because I was a day behind you, so I had a lot to go and see.
Yeah, so you went and saw Pino.
Yeah, I started with Palazzo Grassi to see the show of Julie Meritu, along with artists she chose to show alongside, including David Hammonds and a number of others.
Humababa, Tacita Dean.
There's more.
There are more.
Paul Pfeiffer.
Paul Pfeiffer, yes.
And we're missing one in specific.
I think we're missing more than one, but...
Neri Bagram.
Yes. What do you think of the show?
I thought it was not very good. I mean, it was a good show of her work, but it didn't make her work look very good, especially the newer paintings. Some of the early work is incredible, but the newer paintings are not. They're not for me. They're not to my taste.
We've seen some good painting shows in the Grassi over the years, though.
I mean, maybe that was kind of what it was. Like, it wasn't maybe that the show was so bad, but like when you the expectations for me. Toyments, things like this, when you walk into that building.
Marlene Dumas.
Stingle, Dumas. Mm-hmm. It didn't tickle me like that. And like, I don't know, for me, David Hammonds is one of my favorite artists. And he's someone that's hard to stand up to if it's just a couple of his works. And like, I was just taken with his works and the paintings just faded into the background.
Right.
They looked like decor to me, especially the later work. Now there's all these deep... psychological and kind of media intense effects that she's working with, especially in the later work. But it just doesn't do it for me, man.
Got it. Well, I liked it.
Billionaires liked love it. So lady, you know, what about it. Me? Yeah. Hey, lady's the most important one.
Lady was grabbing Lucy's phone trying to take pictures.
No, oh, was she? Yeah. All right. So, you know, maybe lady has something up on me. What did you do with your Monday morning?
Well, we're talking about Tuesday now. I know it's confusing, but Tuesday...
Keep me on track here, man. Keep me on track.
I went to the Venice Biennale.
Oh, we got an early preview. Well, let's circle back to that in a minute then, I think, because I don't want to get off track, because no one really wants to hear us talk about the art. They mostly want us to hear us speak about the food. I also had seen the de Kooning on just after that at the Academia, and then had like an okay lunch. It wasn't great. I had my vongole.
That's good.
So that was important.
That's great.
But it wasn't a favorite thing. And then, you know, we bumped into, as we were leaving lunch, we bumped into Max LaVey and Toto Mosto, who's a great Venetian young guy here. And they gave us a sneak peek into their show, which I think we'll talk about in a second. But it was great to get in there while they were still installing and see this palazzo in daylight hours.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
It was a very, very special experience. And skipping ahead, yeah, I just wandered around, saw a lot of the shows. And then I think you and I then... met back up to see a show together. Well, actually, I'm going to tell the truth here. I was wandering around lost in a palazzo, and Nate said, Benjamin, it's this way.
God, was that Tuesday? It was Tuesday.
According
to
my phone picture, yeah. It says Tuesday on here.
Forgive us. It's been a week. Tuesday, we went and saw a great show of James Lee Byers with a Korean artist who was born the same year as Byers.
and had these fantastic, fantastic pictures. I mean, the work went so, so, so well together.
Mm-hmm.
And Jamie Lee Byers, like, every time I see work by him specifically in Venice, I am absolutely blown away. There's something about what his particular choice of materiality, kind of how it intersects or plays off the kind of like decaying Venetian backgrounds when they stage works of his here, mm-hmm. that just knock my absolute socks off.
I agree. I remember they installed that gigantic sculpture, the totemic sculpture, some years ago, and it was a true highlight of that year. I think 2017 Venice Biennale. And then what did we do after that? We went to Harry's, didn't we?
We did stop into Harry's, mm-hmm. some of us for longer than others. And I love that when you go up, when you go into the Harry's here, when you head upstairs, they have the Harry's time clock, which gives you the time mm-hmm. in Venice, London, and New York.
Yeah.
I think that's important. I love that.
It's very important for a number of reasons. That's where Harry's is. And it's just where you need to know what time it is.
Yeah, we wandered upstairs. They had some nice little chiquette set up. You had a couple martinis.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was still on the water tray, and I hadn't quite gotten to the Diet Coke portion of the evening as of yet. And the room was already filling up for a big dinner that the Michael Werner Gallery and Gordon Vanna Clausen was hosting. You were just there for the cocktails portion because you're a busy, busy man.
Did you have some of the little sandwiches that they put out?
I had all the sandwiches, Nate.
Those sandwiches are a favorite of Truman Capote's, Hemingway's, Orson Welles.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell the people? I'm not as familiar with the history of Harry's. Do you want to give a quick 90-second lesson for those who may be listening?
I don't know if I have the whole history necessarily off the dome.
The high points, like why it's such an important institution.
I think it was a bit of an expat hang for Brits and Americans who counted themselves as Italophiles, who had come to Venice. Artists, of course. It was just a hub for, you know, the intelligentsia for a long time, and they always served those weird fucking sandwiches. I think they used to make them with prawns, and now they have a sort of few different recipes. They're all very mayo-y. They're really delicious.
Yeah, they're a great little base layer, mm-hmm. I would argue, for whatever the night's bringing into your body subsequently.
And when you're downstairs at the bar just ordering your Bellinis, they just bring them out for free. You know, it's like it's not like you have to order them. Though the Bellinis are quite.
Oh, really? Yeah, I've never paid for a Bellini. Here in Venice, anyway.
I did not pay for one either, but whoever was paying spent some money. Thank you, yes. Thank you, Martin.
Oh, really? Amazing. And then I stayed on for dinner for that show, and it was an incredibly a beautiful room. It was upstairs at Harry's, and like a powerful room. So many people were there. Mark Spiegler, former director of Art Basel, Noah Horowitz, director of Art Basel, a number of like kind of private individuals. I don't want to blow up the spot by listing their names, but I was so well seated. We thought it was the kids' table, but it was definitely the fun table. And like we got into it, man. Remind me, I'm blanking the name of the director of Sculpture Center who I love to pieces.
Sarab.
Oh my God. When he and I got in, we were just,
he's the man.
John, we were the entertainment for a portion of our table, I'd say, he and I going back and forth.
Oh, that's great.
That was really, really good. I had a woman sitting to my right, a Brazilian woman who is starting will be the founding director of a private foundation in Portugal, focusing on ceramics, on a 90-year-old ceramicist's collection he's been building for many, many years of Chinese export ceramics from the 17th and 18th century.
Very cool.
And then we'll build that out within contemporary ceramics. It emerged very late at the end of the dinner that person is her grandfather.
Ah.
And then I had the director of the Economu collection on my table. It was fucking great. And then Wonderful. The table hopping started. Max from the Met stopped by and had a chat. There was a famous football player there that I only know because I posted a picture of them cutting the meringue cake, like a little video.
Mm-hmm.
And in the background, there was some very, very famous German soccer player. And our friend Baume made sure to point out to me who that was.
Thank you, Baume, for that. We would have no idea who that person is.
No, definitely not at all. And we stayed there pretty late. And like the food was like on point, man. Mm-hmm. Just what I was in the mood for. And they really, they piled it on all the hits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it was late. Like, you know, it was like 11:30 by the time dessert was being served.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, you're not getting out of dinner here before 11:30. It's just not happening, you know.
And I wanted to make it an early night because for me, it was going to be the opening of the Biennale the next day and for most of the people. And so, but, you know, then we ended up going to the Gritti. And the best part of kind of doing anything after dinner for me in Venice is the walk there and back. Not only is it beautiful and mm-hmm. gorgeous and serene because it's dark and less of the day tripper or kind of daytime tourists are out, but like everyone that is out is kind of like 60% chance someone you know.
Right.
And just saw everyone on the wander and a lot of just kind of walking handshakes, quick hugs, stop and chats in the middle of one of the most beautiful cities in the world. I live for this fucking shit, Nate.
I do too, man. It's kind of a lot if you're in the process of getting somewhere and you're very late, or if you're, you know, trying to send an email or something and you just hear your name and you're like, I would love to really hang right now, but I got places to be, things to do. But apart from that, of course, I'm gracious for anyone who said hello to me, especially, you know, the people who just came up and said, hey, you don't know me, but I love the pod.
I get a little bit of that,
that
too.
Was great.
I get a little bit too. I'm trying to think of specifically who I bumped into. Sophie Cohen definitely had like a full stop and chat with her. She's in between everywhere. She's here. I think she left today, actually.
She's going to Tokyo.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Tokyo en route to Beijing.
Right. And so, yeah, I went to a dinner. The Gagosian Gallery gave for Rick Lowe. He has a show here in Venice. Great show. Dinner was I think, spectacular. In this very ancient palazzo, it was built on the ruins of a Byzantine-era palazzo from the 13th century.
Is this where the show was or where the dinner was?
Where the dinner was. The show was at another palazzo. And it was a wonderful crowd. I caught up with Michael Craig Martin for a while, who's a great guy to hang out with. I don't know if you've ever spent any time with him.
No, I mean, I know his daughter, but I don't think I've ever hung out with him.
Really, really fun guy. Mostly to the director of the Hirshhorn, my local contemporary art museum, as a D.C.
And
Melissa's
cool, too.
She's very cool. Tom Finkelpearl, the former arts commissioner of New York City,
was
there.
What does he do now?
He's writing a book.
Cool.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it was a wonderful crowd. You know, I think it was just, you know, very, very classy evening. Wine was fantastic.
Seated dinner with name cards.
Dinner,
great.
Name cards, everything. The works, yeah. Again, I got home like very late because the dinner went very, very fucking late. But that's fine.
Yeah, that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. Was Larry in attendance?
No, he was not. I don't know if he's in town.
I think we'll find out tonight.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, so that was that. And then for me, the next day was the opening of the Biennale. And I think for most people, they did a press and kind of professionals, curators preview the day before that you attended so people can file on deadline and really see it with even less crowds. I started with the Arsenale and did the whole thing, including the national pavilions that were there.
Mm-hmm. Any highlights?
Oh, man, that's a tough one to ask me right now. I'd have to look back at the pictures. The Lauren Halsey, for me, is like one of the more significant artworks in the entire exhibition, I feel like.
I think so, too. It's just a monumental thing. I mean, I think there are a very specific kind of totems. I don't want to...
Yeah, I believe it's Corinthian columns, but I don't have the press release in front of me, and each one is topped by the head of an important woman in her community or life, ranging from someone who's like a great community music teacher for many, many years in South Central, and like her grandmother is one of the other ones, and then the kind of, that's at the very top, and then the bottom is kind of filled with the similar kind of signage and markings to what we saw on the rooftop of the Metropolitan Museum a summer ago. It's absolutely incredible. And it really fits in Venice, and it has the kind of, oh, wow, but then it draws you in factor that I'm always looking for in singular works of contemporary art. The show as a whole, there's some other highlights.
You're just talking Arsenale right now?
I'm just talking Arsenale. Well, I'm going to talk Arsenale and Giardini because I think you need to read them. And when I say the Giardini, just the International Pavilion, because I think they need to be read together as one exhibition. And it's a real whiff. From my standpoint, I think it was a real missed opportunity. There's a totalizing effect of all these practices that are really unfamiliar to a lot of people, if not most people. And I don't think it does great service to these artists. You know, there's standouts. There's some great objects. There's a ton of pictures. And there are a couple things I want to research and learn more about. But on the whole, like it didn't feel like it had the impact or like it had the potentiality to change the dominant discourse, which I think was one of the aims of the exhibition, to show forgotten or unknown practices that are outside of the mainstream canon and to kind of counterpoint them to that canon, maybe either make an argument for bringing them into that canon or an entirely different canon. And from my very obviously Eurocentric, American-centric, male-centric point of view, it didn't make me feel the urge to do as such. And I went in there wanting that. I went in there with the desire to rethink what the narrative arc of art history over the last 120 years is. And it just felt like it was, you know, it just the display techniques, and it just felt it didn't have the impact that I was hoping that it did. I'm sure others will have other readings. I'm sure much smarter people will write much longer pieces analyzing it. But that was my initial takeaway. Obviously, I was only there for, you know, 5 hours. I didn't read every single wall text. I didn't read the catalog essays. And I will have the privilege of coming back here at least once more this year, I think. So maybe my opinion will change. But that's my initial gut reaction. And honestly, that's what a lot of the buzz at dinners was from people across the spectrum, other artists, curators certainly, which surprised me. I thought curators would be more sympathetic to the project, and the journalists that I checked in with. And I'm not speaking of you. I'll let you speak for yourself, but some other folks that I checked in with.
Yeah, so you don't necessarily disagree with the approach, but the follow-through, it didn't create the kind of exhibition that can justify this approach. Is that sort of what you're saying?
100%. Like, no. It's kind of a risk, but I'm open to like risk-taking and radical forms of exhibition making. Like, I'm here for it. I want it. But if you're going to take that kind of... if you're going to call your pitch and point to the fucking wall, you better smash that pitch up and over it. And this was kind of like a dribbly, like, maybe a single, like, maybe a fucking ground rule double, but it might have been a whiff, actually.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with you. I think that there was some... you know, great, you know, dignity in the approach that Adriano had. And I think it looked fantastic in places. And I think that, you know, it was a very easy to engage with show. So I think that it's not necessarily something that someone can't get something out of, especially if you're maybe, you know, not as in deep as we are in, you know, this sort of, you know, world. I think that on some level makes it, you know, digestible. And that is interesting to me because it could have been just completely, you know, indecipherable and, you know, very difficult. And it's not difficult. It's, I think, very, you know, crowd-pleasing in a way in that it looks great. The works look nice. But how serious it is as a Venice Biennale, I think, is a question. Like, I don't know if this can live up to the immense pressure that you have with this show. And an easy way to make it a good show is just to get the best artists in the world. And, like irregardless of background and, you know, known or unknown, and just, like, make a show full of bangers. And that's not what Adriano wanted to do. The wall text specifically says this artist has never shown in a Venice Biennale. For a wide majority of the artists. And that seems counterintuitive to me on a lot of levels. Sure, you always want new artists in the Biennale, but you don't necessarily want to exclude artists who have been in it before. There are so many artists who have been in multiple Venice Biennales.
Yeah, I think it could have used some of that contextualization. I think it would have helped the work that was on view to show kind of what it was, even if not directly in dialogue with, but what it was being made with contemporaneously, mm-hmm. in different scenarios. But yeah, I do think it was installed really nicely. I was worried there would be a jumble, but I thought it was very legible as an exhibition, even if I didn't like that legibility or what I was reading. Like that room of the historical work, I forget who designed those beautiful glass partitions. It's a known designer, but that looked fantastic. I think the International Pavilion of the Giardini, which can be a bit of a hodgepodge, I think it was fairly well done. And there was some great videos, and, you know, some stuff looked great. Like, I mean, White Horse, like, I have all these, I do have a number of great pictures. I just really felt like it built itself up as something that it couldn't fulfill. And turning to the national pavilions, which I have seen, the national pavilions that are located either in Arsenale or the Giardini, I think I've seen 80% of them. There's a couple key ones I just couldn't queue up for. I went back this morning and did my best, but the queues were already forming and I just didn't have the time. But there were some good ones. Jeffrey Gibson of the United States, not an artist that's like my a love of mine, or aesthetically. I thought it was like, you know, and maybe it was just in comparison to a lot of the other stuff, like it was very strong. It was a very bold statement. I don't just mean the fact that it's like all these bright colors, but it really took a point of view and drove it home and had a singularity of vision and follow through. I thought the video was actually fucking bananas.
I loved the video.
I really liked the video a lot.
I wanted to talk about the video because, like, you know, going through it, I loved the work, the sculptures. They're amazing. They're objectively great. They're so beautiful. Like you said, the colors are incredible.
I mean, a little garish for me, but yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure. A little garish.
Objectively good,
like,
let's say.
If you just like give into it, you're like, wow, this is nice. But then when you get to the video, it's so fun. It's so like loud and so itself. And it really does distill everything that Jeffrey is going for and his background and what he loves and what he infuses into the work. That I thought that sort of sealed the deal on the pavilion. And also, it's just fucking fun. And like, there's very little fun in the Venice Biennale.
Well, I was about to say that. It has sense of humor and fun. It's dealing with very serious topics of post-colonialism.
Of course. Oh, yeah, of course.
But it's doing it with a sense of humor, a sense of love and joy and beauty. And I think that actually has the potential to be much more effective as a strategy than the didactic ones.
Yes, yes. That's another thing that I kind of liked about the curated exhibition. It wasn't that didactic. It wasn't really bashing you over the head with the sort of central theme. It sort of let the work speak for itself, which I really appreciated. I mean, was it still... I mean, like, the fact that most of the artists are dead is a statement in and of itself.
I mean, the choices that were made and spoken about is in and of itself setting it up as a didactic program.
Sure, yeah. It would be silly to say that it's not didactic. That's true. I just didn't feel, like, beaten down by it. I felt like it was, you know, easy to go through, which is not necessarily a good thing.
No, 100%. No, it was easy to go through. Like, it wasn't like making me angry. It was just making me feel kind of nothing, which is sometimes worse.
Yeah, I mean, like in 2015, Oakley's Biennale, everyone was like, this is so angry. This is so serious.
I mean, I didn't even love that show, but I liked that it made me feel those things.
Right. Any other highlights?
I'm trying to pull up the name right now because I don't want to get it wrong, but I was really taken with the Austrian Pavilion, which was also about serious topics, about displacement. It was an artist that was born in a former Soviet republic by the name of Anna Jermolweva. But had emigrated to Austria as a young person and had like slept rough, as they say over here in Europe, had been homeless for a little bit, sleeping in buses and train stations. And there was a number of her key important works from her oeuvre were on view. There was one that was just these beautiful flowers on chairs, and each flower bouquet was a different color, and that related to a color revolution that had happened. But it was like a really elegant way. There was these five telephone booths from Poland in the 1990s or late 80s that had been installed in one of the in Austria. It had been installed in one of the refugee camps there at a certain point in time, and supposedly that they had the most international minutes at this location of anywhere in Austria during the period they were installed. And to think about the conversations back home that happened within this booths, and then she restaged this bench she had slept on for a long time. I think the most effective and touching work was this work called Swan Lake. And it was an empty set where several times a day a ballerina goes in and rehearses elements of that ballet. And then there was a video when she isn't there showing those rehearsals, and you know, the accoutrements of ballet are left behind. And that's because during the Soviet era, anytime there was a change in leadership or some sort of government unsettlement, all the state TV stations would cut to a filmed version of the Swan Lake ballet. So for her, it was about a notion of turmoil or displacement. So like I thought like that, you know, that's for me, that's very biennial art, right? Like, you know, if I walk into a gallery, like I'm rolling my eyes, but that felt like really important, especially of the moment, because it was about her experiences, but I think it was about the experience of displacement, the experience of foreigners everywhere, if nothing else. So I thought that was a very, very successful pavilion, and I liked it because it was a practice that I was heretofore not familiar with, and it introduced to me, and it gave me the whole kind of breadth and depth of that practice.
Totally. Other pavilion highlights. What do you think?
I mean, everyone loved Germany and the UK.
Yep.
I was like, okay, I don't, you know.
I like them both. They didn't really you know, grab me by the fucking lapels exactly. I like John Comfort a lot. I think this is maybe some of the best work he's ever made. It's not necessarily reverberating in my brain.
I mean, it was incredibly well done.
Yeah.
It felt very expensive in there.
Yeah, it
felt
did.
Very, very expensive. It was a good show. He's a good artist. It was like, it was so totalizing. And it's kind of, I really liked it. I'm trying to pull up the name right now. I very much liked the Korean Pavilion. I thought
yes.
that was incredible. Playing on this sense of smell and place where the artist worked with a number of perfumiers. First, she did kind of a sociological study asking people for their scent, their verbal scent impressions of Korea. And then worked with some perfumiers, I'm not sure what you'd call them, to create a scent, and it was a sculpture that was pushing that out. And it's Yuko Mori.
A lot of smelly art.
A lot of smelly art. We're in Europe. A lot of smelly people, bro. That was so cool. I also really, really liked the French Pavilion an awful lot.
Julien Cousette? Is that how you pronounce his
name? I thought that was like, and talk about like Biennial. It's like all this like insane installation and videos, but I thought they were poetic and beautiful and touching.
It was cool. It was a really cool one. Very much for that.
And I do want to highlight, you know, I really am a big fan in some ways of Claire Fontaine, who lent their title to the exhibition, Foreigners Everywhere, based on a series of neon signs they've done all over the world in different languages and alphabets, including at Rena Spalling's in New York back in the day.
Claire Fontaine.
They caused when it was installed down in Seward Park, caused a lot of agita in the local primarily Orthodox Jewish community there. I'm not sure if you were around for that. Yeah, it was like a thing.
Oh, wow. I totally missed that thing.
And I thought that their installation of, I don't know, dozens of those neon signs in different languages, despite getting the Yiddish one backwards, I thought was very, very good. But you know who definitely did not like that piece if he had seen it, because he hates the title so much so that he's advocating and starting a petition for it to be changed.
Who's that?
Anish Kapoor.
That's right. Anish Kapoor does not like the title.
It seems like a really weird position to take by him.
Weird hill to die on, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know if he needed to insert himself into this particular dialogue. I mean, this is a guy that sells, who's a very good artist, we're going to leave that aside,
sure,
and sells $1 million-plus sculptures on the regular. Mm-hmm. They cost a ton of money. He's like a property magnate. He's got a palazzo here in Venice. For him to feel as though the global southern curator of a show, I would say predominantly inclusive of people of color, is somehow making a racially problematic statement with the show title is not true.
It's not true.
I have problems with the shows I've just, I think, elaborated on, but the title's fine. Good. Good even. It's a strong title.
Yeah, no, it is. And, you know, Anish Kapoor 2 years ago had one of the best shows here. Love the guy.
Yeah, it's like he was feeling left out. He wanted to get his name in there.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know. Shut the plaza here.
Back to the pavilions. I also, and I forget what country this is, so I can't talk about it. I have the artist's name, but not the country on this picture. I really liked the Australian Pavilion by Archie Moore, which tracked the lineage of indigenous people from Australia going back like hundreds of years, doing this crazy wall installation of names, and then like kind of heartbreakingly this almost architectural installation of all these masses of stacks of very orderly done paper so that it looks like a city or something on this huge, I mean massive, you know, 10 meter by 10 meter plinth. It was all documentation of native peoples, Aboriginal peoples from Australia that had been taken from their homes and put in state schools that were, I think, intended to westernize them, similar to what happened in the U.S. and in Canada with First Nation peoples. It was kind of documenting the abuses. Sure, didactic, but because it was aestheticized, I think sometimes aestheticizing something like that makes it more impactful on a soul level than just reading about it would on a cerebral level. So I really liked that National Pavilion as well.
And I think, you know, one more pavilion to mention. I think, you know, artists aside, one of the most beautiful pavilions in the Giardini is Canada's. We love Canada's pavilion. It's got a tree in the middle of it.
Oh, it is a good pavilion.
It's a really good one. Kapwani Kawanga. Really, really wonderful, beautiful.
Is that the glass beads?
The glass beads.
That was a beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. That was a great one.
That was definitely a highlight. Wow, it seems like we're being pretty exhausted.
We are being exhausted. The Japanese pavilions. Mm-hmm. I think the national pavilions are good, man.
Japanese pavilion was cool.
They're almost all new artists to me. The Japanese pavilion, I don't have it up here. I'm not going to cycle back through my photos. I moved on already. But I'm using a lot of like fruit to kind of and audio files, using the electricity from the fruit to create audio sounds through these great speakers in a beautiful kind of way, and the fruit's decaying, so the oscillation of these sounds is changing, the frequency of them, and you're beginning to smell the fruit as it rocks. It reminds me of those old clocks you used to make in elementary school using a potato to power it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was it was a great show. It was a great thing.
And I think let's move on, I think, to what we did after that last night.
I made a quick stop at the artisanal gelateria La Mela Verde. Highly recommend.
Okay,
tuck
great.
That aside. Really, really good gelato. And as I was standing there, I bumped into Matt Bangzer and Abby Bangzer. They were like, oh, and they're big foodies, as I am. But even they're more research-based. And they're like, oh, you know about this place? This place is so good.
Wow. So wait, is it a really special gelateria here?
Well, it's like it's organic. They use really local, high quality. Yeah, you want that one. Really high quality. Excuse me, listeners. Nate is dropping one of my last caffeinated pods into the Nespresso machine to wake himself up. But it's for all of our benefit. So
I haven't
it's all
had
good.
Espresso since the morning. I never do that. I'm like literally, I think, going into withdrawal.
You can hear it in the background. And by the way, I'm not editing it out. I went and checked out the Rick Lowe exhibition, which I didn't 100% love as much as you did. It was fine, totally fine. Beautiful Palazzo. I love the Gagosian organization has seemed to have that quote unquote museum on lockdown. Every Biennale, they have one of their artists in there. It was Mary Weatherford last year, Rick Lowe this year. So we'll see who they get next year. But it's a beautiful Palazzo that had some great historical pictures in it as well that took some time. And then I went to go see Michele Barberetti's gallery.
Yeah, tell
after
me about
that.
This, because I really want to see this, and I'm not sure if I'll have time. It's a Nanaka Hill
collaboration that they kind of co-curated together, and it is an incredible show. It started with a Japanese ceramicist, and they kind of built out the show around that. I don't have the press release in front of me, and I'm not going to be able to pull it up right now, but I saw so many incredible things. I mean, it's easy for me to talk about the people I know, such as the incredible Sterling Ruby piece that is in that show.
Mm-hmm. There's a Sam Gilliam, I think. I saw Rodney Instagramming this today.
Incredible Sam Gilliam. Actually, I sent some notes to a friend, so I'm going through my text, and it was a lot of it was new work to me from both older and younger artists from Asia, and it was kind of, I got the feeling that I was hoping the Biennale was going to give to me, like, give me something outside of my very narrow cultural purview that will change my understanding of the art that has been made or that could be made today. The older artist, Noboya Hitsuda, was actually the painting teacher of Nara. He's still alive.
Oh. Whoa.
He's in his 80s, but doesn't make work anymore, so it was all older work. And they're incredible, incredible paintings. You wouldn't, there's no visual, there's no, on the surface level, there's no immediate identification with Nara, but to understand the kind of history of student and teacher in that culture, you know, we know it so well in the German, like, you know, German painting teachers and how it was passed down. To see it in that culture was incredible. And just these pictures, I mean, they're fucking banging. I want to own them. They're
That's
incredible.
So sick.
They're incredible. Really, wow. really, really good. And then a young artist that was like, I mean, these things are so good. These beautiful organic paintings. Rina Sugihara. They had one painting by her. I think it's her. It's an incredible picture. Like I actually do want to own that. It's in a somewhat approachable price point. I may try to own it for myself.
Wow. Cool.
But the show itself, I mean, what Michele is doing in that space and coming back to his roots in Venice and making it, sure, he has these, you know, he sees a lot more visitors. And I was, you know, during the Biennale time and while it's up, and I was like, but is it sustainable, like, you know, around, you know, year round, you know, when it's not that every 2 year thing? And he said it's great because so many people come through Venice for vacation, for a holiday, that are contemporary art people like Berggruen that have, you know, places here, and others coming through. Artists love to do shows there. He's built out an incredible, gorgeous space. It was perhaps on the younger side of things one of my favorite exhibitions in Venice right now.
Very
I know
cool.
It's a commercial show. I know it's not, you know, a curated thing, even though it is curated, but it's curated as a selling exhibition. absolutely, absolutely love it. Can't speak highly enough about it.
Amazing.
And I want to, while I'm feeling in a positive state of mind and while you're getting yourself caffeinated, I want to go back to a show that you saw before me. I was able to go back, I forget which day it was before the Biennale opened, to the second half of the Pinot collection of the Ponte della Dogana to see the Pierre Huig exhibition, which is as far as large scale single artist exhibitions, not just in Venice, sure in Venice, but just about anywhere of a living artist, is one of the most incredible art exhibitions I have ever seen.
Yeah, it really is. I think when we potted last time, I had just seen it and was still kind of shell-shocked. There's nothing else like it anywhere. I mean, he's the master. Like, he really is.
It sets a tone and changes. It is both in keeping with the present moment of history that we're in outside the world and changes my understanding of it on a, not on just a kind of top material level, but on a deep soul level, on a molecular level. It is creepy. It is dark. It is technically so highly proficient. It is all the things, and he creates a mood and a tempo. And it's work going back almost 20 years, so it's not like he created it all for this, but it's all in keeping with his particular aesthetic and intellectual concerns. I can't speak highly enough about it being something everybody needs to see.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a huge mistake to miss that in Venice. I don't think anyone will.
And I know he had like a big museum retrospective that was in the United States at LACMA and then at MoMA, I think it traveled to. I'm not sure about the second half. I definitely saw it at LACMA.
Right? Yeah, it's not like he's lacking for shows necessarily, but still, like, to see it at the scale in the Dogana, which is an amazing space to see art, any art, is really spectacular.
Incredibly, incredibly special. So I love that. I think I'm going to go try and go see it again this evening real quickly. We'll see. Cool. TBD if the boat schedules work out for me. Getting across the Grand Canal, you really get to separate your day into like this side and that side.
Yeah,
for maximum efficiency. The lack of my ability to be as efficient as I would like, and I've still seen a ton of stuff, is really, really hard. And last night, I kept it pretty casual. I was really happy that I didn't have any seated dinners on the agenda, so I was able to keep the dress maybe a little too casual, someone said to me. Thanks, Mayor. I can always get the truth out of her. I started my evening kind of running around trying to see a bunch of things, saw that show, tried to go see the show that was about breasts and art, and then I walked in and realized it was sponsored by a bra company, and there was a line, and I had zero interest.
Wow.
I know our friend Chloe and former guest is on it, Chloe Wise, so it's kind of, I told her I'd see it, but it was too much for me. I couldn't handle that.
I mean, I haven't seen it. I would like to see it for Chloe, and I'm sure we have other friends in it as well.
I then ran across to see Iwa Jerkowitz's exhibition in yet another private palazzo that was pretty dope, actually, and really? It was very elegant.
Yeah, I'm a fan of hers.
Yeah, me, I as well. I've placed several of those pictures. They look really good in the historical rooms. I mean, so many things look great in these historical rooms of these old palazzos. And that was being, that was like really elegantly hosted. Everyone looked great. Most importantly, I found someone that had a boat so we could get to the next thing in a speedy manner. That always
nice.
Makes my life a little bit easier.
Wonderful.
That I didn't have to pull out the wallet for. So only spent 15 or 20 minutes there, kind of jawing it up. Bumped into Antonio, who will be our host for this coming weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Our friend Fallon, and then we hightailed it over to
the Daniele.
Daniele walked right in, or jumped right in off the boat. Saw our host from this last weekend, Tony Salome, there jawing it up on the phone. Just did a quick wave. He recognized and waved back. Love that. And like they, the Tim Taylor and Blum and Poe and whatever other galleries,
Max Hessler.
All collaborated to throw a standing dinner. It was like 150 people. It wasn't my favorite venue for an event this week.
It was the hotel lobby, which is fine. Daniele's a nice hotel, but like, yes, it was in the lobby.
It meant they could have a very democratic guest list policy, yes. I suppose, which is nice. Eddie's such a, so many people love him. Bumped into you there. Eventually, Lady showed up, which was the highlight of my night, honestly.
Oh yeah, and mine too, of course.
And of course your wife. I hadn't seen Lady in a while, and that was super fun to see her running through the lobby of that hotel. That made me smile really wide. Bumped into our friend Martin there, Michael Fuchs, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's there. I sat with Eddie for a good 10 minutes and just kind of chatted with him. He was kind of off to the side. I'm not sure if he loves a cocktail party, Sitch.
But it was a great one, and yeah, a really great crowd. Everyone's in a great mood. And then we ran over to a little.
Well, let's be honest. We tried to get a boat. We we'll just ask the concierge of the Daniele to get it for us. Like, they'll hook it right up. Like, you know, there's enough of us, we'll all throw in. We had a fairly large posse that wanted to head over to the next thing. And they're like, yes, of course. 45 minutes. We're like, shit. We can walk there faster than that.
In fact, I beat you there.
I don't know. We were all walking.
And I left after you.
Yeah, and I was with some like very well-bred British guys that seemed to know where they were going, but evidently. Lucy knows.
Was Lucy
the compass on that one?
I think it was me, but both of us, we sort of know our way around this point.
Okay. Yeah, you grinned like a Cheshire cat when we walked up. It was only a matter of like not even 60 seconds.
No, we barely edged you out. And we got to this wonderful palazzo that is, like you said, in the family of our friend Toto.
Toto Mosto, and
Toto's father, I believe.
Well, it's his grandparents' house. And they're
right,
still,
yes.
I know the grandmother's still alive, was in residence, was there. I have not met her. She did not come down, I don't think, last night.
It's a big palazzo.
It's a big boy palace. Yeah. It's a really, really special place. And we were there, before we get to the awesome party, for a really special show that our friend Max LaVey put on. And it's hard to have critical distance. I know, listener, we've used his name enough in places like Montauk and Costa Rica that you probably think, like, you know, he's paying us or something
to say
what I'm about to say about this show. He was able to assemble this incredible exhibition of Frank Auerbach paintings, one work on paper, a painting on paper, though, and it looks so good and so professional. It is incredible.
Yeah.
They fill the ground floor of the palazzo as you kind of walk in off the street, or if you arrive via boat, which we didn't, via boat. And it is like he worked with a designer and architects to really find a way to insert these paintings into that space without obviously touching the walls, the electricity, and just fucking knocked it out of the park. There's some important Auerbach paintings in this show.
It looked amazing in there. I mean, like, he's just a painter that just works so well here in Venice. The sort of the gloominess, the seriousness just like plays well, very well against these, you know, ancient looking structures and homes. And it's a banger.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And then we moved upstairs to the Piano Nobile. Is that how you say it? Nobile?
Sure, yeah.
The noble floor.
And there were martinis, there were snacks, there was a whole array of people.
But most importantly, we were in people's living quarters. Yeah. It's a palazzo in Venice that hasn't been fucked up, hasn't been overly touched. It's been the setting of movies such as The Talented Mr. Ripley, mm-hmm. Not the Netflix or whatever TV show it's on now.
The fucking Anthony Daniel one.
Yeah. It's incredible. You know, the buffet for food and some of the drinks were served in their dining room.
Yeah.
And, like, it was incredible. Toto's father, whose first name is escaping me right now, I think Francesco, we're in Italy, most of them are, took Nate and I for a little tour of some of the other rooms, which is, I think, a very special moment. I know it was a special moment for me, pointing out the frescoes, some of the furniture, the mirrors, which are original. This building, the architect of this palazzo also was the architect of the Rialto Bridge.
That's right.
And there were some real architectural innovations where on that Piano Nobile, the almost fully glass walls in that main room, allowing light to come in from two sides. That wasn't a normal thing in the like 15th century. And you know, there's these two pillars and an archway that are holding up the walls of four floors above that level. But allow light to cascade in, which must have been absolutely majestic, especially in a time before electric lights or before the notion of like office towers with glass walls. I mean, this was kind of the first, you know, sort of hanging glass wall as we think of it now across Midtown, you know, that we see across Midtown Manhattan. So special.
Wow. Yeah. Real like history in architecture right
history.
There. Yeah.
And there's also a half floor below that we gained entry to, which mm-hmm. there's an apartment level. Like
very cool. Like the hippest, coolest Venice apartment I've ever seen.
I don't think I could paint a word picture, honestly, that will help you understand, listener, how dope this place was. It was for me, it was out of the pages of World of Interiors 10 years ago.
Yeah, it kind of felt like you were in The Talented Mr. Ripley or something, and you were in the 50s, and you were an Englishman who was coming back to these ancient structures and that had been abandoned for centuries and finding them and letting your sort of inner love for Italy take over and like making a life for yourself here, something like that.
At one point, I walked up to our friend Martin. I was like, because I was going out to get some Coke Zeros because they didn't have any like real non-alcoholic beverages. I was like, hey, you're going to be here for a minute? He's like, I'll be here for the next 2 days.
Yeah. Where else? Where else would you go?
You know, it was great to see there. It was one of the reasons I think Michael made the extra effort to come with us, Fuchs, was that Maya was there. His daughter has been working for Max on this show. Mm-hmm. Previously, she'd been an intern at the Guggenheim, which, by the way, young people, if I had to do life all over again, applying for that internship definitely would be high on my list.
Yeah, it seems like a
at the Peggy
no-brainer.
Guggenheim Foundation here.
It not only is like a very legit internship that can get you actual jobs, jobs afterward because it's a rigorous program and it looks good in the resume. It, like, it actually does.
You get to live in fucking Venice.
You get to live in Venice. Yeah. Like, how great is that?
I know. I plan on telling my kids about it.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Trying to
totally.
Hype them up. But it was a pretty incredible party. Did you have the risotto?
Yeah, it was great.
The risotto was really, really good.
It was really really classic preparation.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I needed the fifth or sixth little mini cannolis I had with the pistachio cream.
Yeah, you were going hard in those. I had a few of them myself.
I need a little, without the booze, I need a little sugar in
addition
to the caffeine to kind of like, but I went overboard. There's no denying that. I didn't need the fifth or sixth, like I said. And we stayed there pretty late. There was a big movement for some of the young ladies really wanted to go to the big rave that was happening out at the Lido Airport for Michelle Lamy. It's 80th birthday party.
Yeah.
I didn't get on that water taxi.
No, I also.
I was real concerned, like, how do you get back from there? And then I saw some videos from there. Real glad I didn't go, bro. It wasn't for me. Whew. It was amazing, but for someone else.
It made me exhausted just looking at those videos.
And I did try and, I did attempt to walk by with a bunch of people to Tolga's party. I walked up to the entrance, saw a scrum of people, and was like, again, not for me.
Right.
But the Stop and Chats on the way there and then on the way to my hotel from there, top notch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Yeah, I just went home as well. Getting ready for tonight. I don't want to get into it too much if we're going to recap it on the next pod, which is only in a few days.
If anyone's still listening after I'm just blathering about these parties. And you have some exciting stuff coming up, though. But we'll save that for the column that you're about to do after this.
Right.
I went and tried to like knock out a bunch more pavilions today. I kind of got thwarted. Like, I went to go to the Nigerian pavilion because I wanted to see Tunji's painting, but they were like, no, we're closing now.
There's a cocktail that starts actually right now. So if you wanted to go back, I can't, but you could.
That's a schlep. I did it. I made the attempt. I tried to go to Svetlana Maric, curated some show that looks like it's an art fair inside. I went in. They're like, oh, can you register on the iPad?
No,
I can't. I'm really I'm politely, no thanks. Like, yeah. I'm tight for time. I did go to the Peggy Guggenheim museum because it's just one of my favorite places in Venice to sit in that garden. And they had a wonderful Jean Cocteau show that is the film director, poet, artist, absolutely incredible.
There's a little party there tonight. I might stop by, just see the show.
It's really good.
Too many things going on.
But right now, I'm looking at the clock. I'm also looking at the fact that we've hit the 60-minute mark. I know you got a roll. I want to go see a couple more things before the evening events. There's so much more to cover. I know we just scratched the surface, but I think we got to say, nota bene,
out.